Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprise and health. This is podcast number 5. I'm Dave Dawes, and this week we're doing another interview with Chris Dabbs, where we're looking at the transition from a predominantly grant-funded organisation to a predominantly contract-funded organisation. Okay, and this is our second interview with Chris Dabbs from Community Health Action Partnership, CHAP, which is a social enterprise in Salford, and also coordinator of the NHS Network Social Enterprise Network. And what we thought we'd pick your brains about, Chris, is the transition from being a predominantly grant-funded organisation to a predominantly contract-orientated, because there's a whole chunk of social enterprises I'm coming across which are, I mean, a lot of them are almost charities, for want of a better word, and they're trying to shift their income base from, you know, either local authority grants or, you know, things like New Deal for Community grants or three-year lottery funding grants. So kind of how do you make that transition from that sort of world to contract-based income or predominantly?
I mean, I think our experience with Community Health Action Partnership, which started off through a regeneration initiative and very much a grant-driven organisation. I think what really enables the transition to take place first of all is a desire for independence as much as anything else. That you want to get free from the dependence on the local council and the NHS or what have you.
Because some funders, I mean, take that relationship to a really quite far degree of like, you will do this, you will do, and it's almost almost being line managed by their organisation.
And the amount of paperwork you have to fill in, the boxes to tick and all the rest of it. And actually, it can be more expensive to do that than to even to get a loan by the time you actually count up the staff time and all the rest of it. But I think as much as that, for our social enterprise, which is a community-owned social enterprise, there's also something which is about trying to break the ties of dependence generally that often a particularly deprived community has of, you know, it's a sort of, when are they going to do something for us type of mentality. And to a degree, almost hopefully being an example of what local people can do from our point of view. But really looking beyond that to say, well, if we're only ever reliant on grants, we can't ever make a surplus, which means that we can't...
Yeah, because people take it back. If you don't spend your money and you have a bit of a surplus, they often go, right.
If you have your own surplus, you can start to decide on what you want to do with the money. So I think independence is a really important driver. But it's also opening up all the possibilities that there are about different ways of securing money, much greater flexibility, and the ability to start doing entrepreneurial or innovative things once you've established yourself. And that's where you can really start to make a difference to your community, your society, the world, or whatever, when you can get that degree of independence and freedom. And that's where the ideas can really start to flow.
And do you think there can sometimes be a difficulty if you've been, I mean, it depends how long you've been in that culture, but if you've been in that grant-giving culture for a long time, there's almost a thing about the way you get money is by making yourself seem poor and needy and, you know, we need this, the typical charity model. And some people I found, they kind of struggle to go from that mentality through to we're really good, we're really excellent, we offer a fantastic service, this is the value of what we do. Did you find any of that or any of the...
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean for me, I suppose personally, I moved away from the whole needs-based approach quite a number of years ago. So I've been focused for a long time on... what some people call an asset-based approach or a strengths-based approach, just saying I want to know what people can do, what they do know, what they're capable of, rather than what they don't know, what they can't do, what their disabilities are, for example. And some of that within CHAP, I think, has been very much just maintaining that discussion, that dialogue, so people see that there is a different way of seeing the world.
Right.
And it's more a worldview rather than just a view for this organisation. It also reflects back on the communities that we come from, that we work with, are saying, right, we don't have to be defined in a negative way, which is frankly largely what the health and social care system does to individuals and communities. It's what regeneration does. You always get asked about what your needs are.
Yeah.
Which is a very negative way of being defined.
I once saw two community groups argue at a conference because one said they had the highest rate of teenage pregnancy in Europe and the other said, no, we've got the highest. Yeah. And it's like, you shouldn't be proud of this. But for them, it was like, well, we get a lot of money because we're this bad.
That's the competition you get thrown into.
Yeah.
But I think there's a real different way of looking at it, which is saying, right, we're going to focus on what people are good at, whether it's... the people we employ, whether it's the people we work with as clients or whoever else. And part of that focus is then saying, most importantly, you have the ability to take control of your life. Mm. Whether you're an employee who's just joined, whether you're the chief exec, whether you're a member of the board, whether you're a community or an individual that we're working with, you have the ability to take control of whatever's going to happen to you. You can be far less dependent. You don't have to wait for those people up there, whoever they might be, to tell you what to do or expect them to come along and solve all your problems, because they won't. Mm. And what I've seen numerous times is at the start of this process, whether it's individuals or people as a group, at the start people resist that if they've been brought up in a dependent culture, whether as individuals or as a community. It's quite a scary concept because, you know, it feels like there's no safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And often for a while people will fight it, resist it. It can take months or even in some cases years, and you just have to keep going at it and just keep telling people how great they are and what skills they've got and what strengths they've got, because it feels completely alien. Particularly if you've come through a culture where all the agencies define you by your needs and tell you you won't succeed, and because of where you've come from or what class you're in or whatever.
And there's almost an unwritten contract. You can have money, you can have these benefits, you can have these resources, so long as you don't start changing what you are.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think what we can, the alternative way, and looking at moving away from that grant dependency or that dependent culture, needs-based culture, negative culture, is about going through a process which at the start will feel scary, which towards the start people will often resist and think is completely wacky or silly or whatever. But at some point what I tend to find is that people at some point will click, and then they suddenly get it.
Right.
And they'll understand what it's about, what it can offer them, or they'll see an example of somebody else down the road who's already clicked, who's getting so much more out of life, or whatever it might be.
So how do you start that process? Because I can see, I mean, you could almost sit down with, I suppose if people listen to this, if you're an established organisation, you've probably got a board, management committee, some staff, community users. Do you start by having discussions with potential purchasers? How do you find out who they are? Do you start internally by going, look, we want to rethink the way we do it?
I suppose, the way that we've done it in CHAP, I suppose there's two issues. I mean, one which is, as an individual for me, is just talking about it with everybody.
Right.
And there's no great plan about it. You just keep talking about it and test people and get reactions and so on, and then you keep talking about it and you listen to what people say. You don't necessarily change your idea, but you adjust it.
Right.
But the core of the idea stays the same.
You might just change maybe the way you present it to people,
yeah,
the language
or it's
you
implemented or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that what's really important is then if you've already got an organisation or you're with a group or whatever, is really spending a long time working out what it is that you're all trying to achieve.
Right.
Because usually what each of you say that you might be signing up to is usually different between each individual. So actually working through and saying, what are we here for? What are we trying to do? And knock it around and spending a lot of time on that. So I think people often don't spend very much time on it, and they assume everybody's in it for the same reason, and usually they're not.
And I've seen it skew, certainly some big charities, very heavily. They start going down a route because they think they'll make some money. Mm. And what starts happening is that becomes more and more of what they do. And the organisation then becomes more about that. And they go, but actually this isn't kind of what we, you know.
Yeah, and I think... particularly at the start, the last thing to focus on is money. If you've got a great vision and you know where you're going, you're developing ideas, the money will come. The money is secondary. But people do often start with all the legal stuff and the financial stuff. Where I'd start is defining or trying to be very clear about what on earth are we trying to do?
Mm.
Let's get really, really focused. Let's be really clear about what we're good at. And then how do we link what we're really, really good at, what our top strengths are, and link it with what we're trying to achieve, what our dream is. If you get that, the passion will come, the drive will come, the focus will come, the ideas will drive, you'll be driven, and the money will just turn up. and I think what we found is that process of working through with a group of people can take quite a long time to get into the way of thinking of that. You know, we look for the positives in people. That's where we start. People have abilities, not disabilities. And particularly if you're working with a deprived community or a group of people who've always been looked on in a negative way, sometimes trying to get how those people are viewed in a different way can just take a long time. And it's just a case of hammering away at it and talking about it all the time and just changing the way that people think until they can see the benefits. There's then a process of, whilst you're doing that, about developing a strategy, developing a structure that you need to create an organisation that reflects those core values that you've developed, that you've got, that reflects what you're trying to achieve, how you want to do things, and you know, in the sort of cliched way, you know, it's function before form. Yeah. Work out what you want to do. And one of the things I would say to people is decide how much time you think it'll take to work out what it is you want to do and what your values are, and at least treble it. And spend more time on that than you ever think would be necessary.
I often say to people, spend some time in a pub, spend some time over meals talking about this, kick it around in environments other than just boardrooms and meeting rooms.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah. Because I think your organisation needs to reflect what you're about and how you work. And so the sort of thing, for example, we've tried to do with CHAP and we're still working on, is to say, okay, you know, we want to change the world and make the world a happier and a healthier place. That's what we're about. We want to do that with the people we work with the communities, but we also want to be an employer that reflects those values. So we then start to ask, well, what does it mean to be an employer that wants to have a happier and healthy world? That means we have to create a happier and healthier
workforce.
What does that mean in terms of what our policies look like and all these types of things? And work it through from scratch. And so for us, because that's our approach, for example, if you come and work for CHAP, one of the things that we'll talk to you about is, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? Not just what training do you need to do this job better.
Yeah.
And we'll seriously talk to you about, okay, what support will we give you if you really want to be a tightrope walker rather than whatever it is you're doing in this organisation? How can we help you to find out how to be a tightrope walker? How do, if you decide you want to do that, how will we help you to train how to be a tightrope walker? Because then you will be more fulfilled, and whilst you're with us, maybe we can develop a service that involves tightrope walking.
Yeah.
And you can stay employed with us if you want to, but also, even if you do decide to move on, we'll see that as a positive, because we'll have ended up changing somebody's life. And also, whilst you're with us, you're more likely to put the maximum
amount of effort.
Yeah, you're
a lot more motivated because,
and you're more likely to stay with us for a longer time. And that will rub off on the people that we're working with. It will rub off on your colleagues. It'll actually start to encapsulate within how we behave what we're about in the first place. So most of this, I think, is about ways of thinking. It's about behaviour. And all the stuff that often is talked about at enterprise and business conferences is just a reflection of those things.
Yeah.
It's just putting a structure in place that reflects what we're about.
So once you've kind of decided, so you've done the internal work, you've thought of a number of new services you could do or income streams, how would you advise someone to go about getting those contacts? Because again, one of the things that I often come across, people say, well, this organisation might be interested, but I don't know how to get into them at all. Or, you know, typically there might be NHS organisations outside their area or local authorities. Yeah. So how do you get through that process of finding who the person is you need to talk to?
I suppose there's a number of ways. I mean, one way is just go to all the possible events where there are people there. I think particularly important is do your homework on the individuals and find out, you know, you have to know the named individual who's going to be motivated by whatever it is that you want to do.
I'm always amazed how few people do that. I always, if I'm meeting someone for the first time, if it's like a business, you know, I'll always Google them. And usually, especially if someone's spoken at a conference, they'll have a biography.
Yeah.
And you can go, oh, right, this is what they did, and this is what they did, and this is what drives them.
Absolutely. And particularly if you can find out some personal background. So if somebody's into cycling, or they love chocolate, or they've got a child with learning difficulty, or whatever it might be, that you try to find ways to engage them,
like as a human being rather than a job title,
and then talk with them, and more importantly, listen to them. Because I think a lot of people go in and say, I need to tell them this, that, and the other, which is fine, but it's as important to really seriously listen at the start of what is it that this person's really interested in, and what are they motivated by, and how can I relate what I want to do to what they're motivated by? And it's in a sense just basic marketing. You know, you listen to whatever it is your potential customer is interested in.
But a lot of people think sales and marketing is, I'm going to tell you about what I do. And it's one of the things I struggle with, because I'd been in the NHS my career before I left, you know, to set up a session, but I'd never worked in sales and marketing. So I thought it was about brochures and leaflets and websites and the rest of it. And it was only when I started listening to real expert salesmen that go, no, I listen to people. If I can't meet their needs, I refer them to other people. I don't try and pitch them something they don't want.
And I think the key issue, in a sense, is relationship building.
Yeah.
That's actually what it's about. So in terms of getting into these organisations, in a sense, but at the start it's about saying, well, the task actually isn't to get into this organisation, it's to build up a relationship and to be very clear about what sort of relationship you want. So for me, it's about things like I want a relationship which is about honesty. It's a relationship where if we're doing things that aren't working, I'll just come and tell you. There's no pretense about it, but also that we're here to try and help solve your problems, but doing it in an interesting and a fun way, and hopefully we all have a good time, and it's an enjoyable time as well as doing serious stuff. But finding out these people, so I suppose going to events, getting yourself known, finding out who's interested in what, because of their personal motivation rather than their job title. But also looking, I think for me, the really interesting bit is looking outside of your usual sphere of interest. So, you know, if you are working from a health and care perspective, and that's what you know about, often the last people you want to go and have a chat with are people who know about health and care, because what you'll talk about is health and care and the same old solutions.
Absolutely.
Go and talk to people who work in the theatre, or people who know about criminal justice, or the people down at the BBC. And usually what I've found is that actually it's much, much easier to get to people, even who are fairly well known, than you actually think it might be.
Mm.
You know, get into the event and walk up to them at the end. Often they'll often talk to you. You know, if it's somebody you know, ring the switchboard up, ask for the direct line number, and then ring the direct line number back, and then normally they'll speak to you.
I always find it funny how and it's a trick. I learnt this one off my mum for some reason. She's a master at, she'd always find out the name of the PA, of the person she was trying to get hold mm-hmm. of. And so when she'd ring it, it'd be like, oh, hello, is that Sally?
Mm.
Oh, is Peter around? And immediately people think, all right, I'll pencil you in the diary.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, whereas if you go, is that the director of finance? They know damn well you don't know who it is.
Well, yeah, and I think that those sort of personal links and... you know, if you can know something about the person as an individual, or you know what their kids are doing, or whatever it might be,
and quite often other people will know them. I it goes back to something we were talking about before about social enterprise tends to be very open and very collaborative.
Yeah,
you know, the number of times where you could say to someone, oh, you know, I could do with meeting and contacting that, and I go, oh, I know someone, and here they are, or you'll do a collaborative piece of work with them. And
oh, sure, the introductions, and I suppose the sort of thing that we're trying to do through the Social Enterprise Network and at NHS Networks is offering people a way to get to know lots of other people that you wouldn't otherwise. And I suppose with all of these things about getting to know people, defining what you're about and so on, helps then to set a direction and also a different way of thinking and a different way of looking at the world, and saying, well, actually, I don't need to focus so narrowly on just the bit of the world that I've known about for a long time.
Right.
And actually, there's more exciting stuff over here, and this is really interesting. And then you start to see if you keep the balance of your social focus and the business side, you'll start to see new opportunities. So for us as a health and happiness based organization, we're talking to people who are looking at issues around worklessness, about crime, we're talking to people who are in the arts, about music and so on, and seeing, right, how can we take one two or more ideas and just twisting them in a new way. But then that opens up new business opportunities or different ways of generating an income, which is say, well, actually, maybe we are a health organisation, but maybe most of our money won't come from health.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, those people who want to reduce the incapacity benefits expenditure for the government, actually, this might be really valuable to them. Or maybe it's the prison who might be interested in this particular approach, or... you know, frankly, we could go and sell some of this stuff to rich people in Cheshire or Surrey or whatever at a premium, or and then, you know, recycle the profits out of that for the benefit of people who can't afford services.
A lot of people seem very linear. They think it's health, it's NHS, or, you know, and that means it's the PCT, or, you know, or it's social, therefore it's the local authority. And you're right, there's lots and lots of other organisations out there and funding streams and so on.
Absolutely. You know. And you know, potentially just even getting away from looking at statutory agencies. So it could be individuals who might pay for something. There may be the statutory agencies, but also you've got, you know, possibilities within the private sector, because you can still create social benefit even though your customer is private. You know, alongside some of the other opportunities that are out there from some of the organisations who are prepared to back social innovation and take risks. But also looking at new ways. So if you had to be working with somebody whose talent is interest is in, I don't know, in dance, then saying, well, how might we take what we know about health and happiness and apply it using dance as a format?
Which kind of goes back to what you were saying about what drives you, what's your goals, what are you excellent at, what's your strengths and passion. And if that sort of pulls you in an area, then... yeah, you know, the money
and then,
will flow.
And then working through the ideas to say, okay, we may come up with a huge number of ideas. A lot of them won't be commercially viable, but every so often you get an idea that is. And then it's make, you know, trying to then turn it into a hard-nosed, marketable service which people are prepared to, you know, to provide you with a sufficient income for.
And I find that sometimes a tricky bit. If you're generating lots of ideas, it's like, well, okay, which of these do we create as serious pilot? Mm-hmm. Which sit on the back burner and, mm-hmm. you know, I have files of loads and loads of ideas and you think, you know, you rummage through them every now and again.
And I think for me, in terms of that process, it's just distinguishing between those people who are the creative people, who are the ones who come up with the ideas, and the people who can turn them into hard-nosed business opportunities. Because rarely is one person in both camps. Yeah. So creating those new ideas is one task. Sorting out which ones are then viable is a completely different task.
And if you try and do that too early, it's like the classic brainstorming stuff, you just cut down all the creativity.
Sure. So the part of the technique, I think, for that, for the newer ideas, is just to create lots and lots and lots of them. Mm. And knowing that, you know, 95% of them have got no chance whatsoever. And that's, for me, is the fun bit. And then getting people to work through them and saying, well, you know, whose requirement is this going to meet? Whose problem is this going to solve? And at the end, who's actually going to pay for this stuff? And if you can do that, you can then start to turn these into genuine enterprising ideas that will lead to an income, whether that's through a single contract with another agency, or whether it's selling it to individuals as individual customers or anything in between. And so particularly in terms of moving away from the grant dependency model, which is largely reacting to what people have already decided you're going to do.
And what the funding agencies want, because you sometimes see people trying to adapt what they do to what funding agencies want.
Which is not a great way of going about doing things. It's actually saying, this is what we're good at, this is the idea, let's go out and we'll just find where the money is that wants to pay for this stuff. It's very rare that you come up with a great idea where somebody isn't prepared to put the money in. But it's the reverse way around. Never chase the money.
People seem a bit sceptical, but I said there is a lot of money out there. If you're very clear about what you are and what you're good at and what your passion is, most people aren't. You know, they focus very much on the money side of it. You know.
And I think, you know, in a wealthy country like the UK, you know, there is no shortage of money, but the... I think that some of the best examples are in some of the poorest countries in the world. And you see, you know, people there who are creating social enterprises and other enterprises, and they can make money out of them.
Well, it's like the Brameen Bank. I mean, it's huge billions of dollars based on tiny, tiny micropayments to people on the street.
It's also commercially viable.
Yeah.
And so even in areas where you think, oh, there isn't much money, you can still make it happen. It's sometimes a bit harder, but certainly in this country, even in a deprived area, there's no end of money going through. If you look at the you know, just the combined incomes of the residents, let alone the businesses, let alone the public agencies, let alone the shops and all the rest of it, money is rarely the problem. The problem is creating sufficient really good ideas, and then spotting the one which then has real viability.
Yeah,
and the trick then is just finding the person who's interested enough to pay you to provide the service.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Chris. And and again, plug for NHS Networks. People want to find out.
Yes, for those people who are interested, it's a network. We've got nearly 1,000 members all over the country who are interested in social enterprise in health and care. Details are on the website, which is worldwideweb.networks.nhs.uk/social-enterprise.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks very much. Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health. And you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's entrepreneurses.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.